I've got my flat shoes on today. I'm usually a lot taller than this. My story is called Confessions of a Fuzzy Man, and there is a clue in the title, but I'd like you to realise that it's from the point of view of a man, and I'm not going to be doing a deep voice. Just thought I'd let you have that in your heads. I haven't always looked like this, a heat haze, a trick of the eye. Once upon a time before the war, I was as crisply cut and definite as the next man. In fact, in my youth, I revelled in my physicality, excelling at tennis and cricket in the summer months and rugby in the winter. I swam for the school, ran for the county, and as I grew into a man, I danced for the pleasure of seeing moonlight splash on a pretty girl's shoulder. In those days, my limbs and profile were just as sharply fashioned as yours are now, even in that somewhat crumpled suit you're wearing. Yes, that's right, though I cannot see you properly, hidden as we are in this gloom, I sense the solidity of your flesh and the contours of your form as you fill up that man-shaped space in the hallway. While you listen to me speak through the crack in this door, straining to catch my words, which I accept must sound very faint by now, I feel the determination of your outline. It is one of the stranger side effects of my disability. A bitter joke, I sometimes think, that despite my own thin-edged and fraying carcass, I sense the denseness and physical consistency of others quite acutely. I was born in 1893, which by anybody's account would make me one of the oldest citizens of the world today. No, I'm afraid I'm not at liberty to offer any further proof. You know my name, of course, and I am sure you will have done all the research you could to track me through the decades to this dark afternoon in this dimly lit place. You will just have to accept that I am indeed who I say I am. You'll know from my birth certificate that I was born in Norfolk, and that my father was a vicar, and my mother, as you might expect, his wife. Perhaps, too, you have discovered that I grew up an only child, and attended first a prep school in Norwich, and then one of the better public schools, before making my way up to Cambridge on a scholarship for athletics. There I studied classics, somewhat haphazardly, and rowing and other sports with a much fonder application. It was also there that I met the best three friends of my life, men I can only describe as my bonded brothers, my shadows, and my sunshine. Harry Flowbird, son of the Right Honourable Member for Witten-on-Styx, a tawny, rangy fellow who made a solid right half and wouldn't let you down in a scuff. Walter Armitage, a poetic mischief with a taste for pranks, whose mother was something notable at court. And closest of all to me, William Fishfitter Meadows, the son of a bishop, and like me, a consummate oarsman. For 3 years, our opinions harmonised, and our youthful personalities were like second skins to one another. We became an accepted quartet at parties, and were written of in the smaller paragraphs of the Times as being exemplary among our generation. Certainly, there was a picture of the four of us that appeared in the back pages of Tatler, where you can see us standing arm in arm on the banks of the Cam with our straw boaters cocked at quite provocative angles. It is one of the last photographs that was taken of me, and one of the few that shows me as I might have been as a man had I not succumbed to this weakness of physicality. That picture also marks the last time we four would lounge together amongst those dear old willows, for the very next day we enlisted for the war against Germany. Willie and I were to serve together with the King's White Devils, and happy and proud for me the day we passed out together under the joint gaze of our respective parents. As luck would have it, Walter and Harry were on the same boat as us going over, and we had some laughs, just like the old Cambridge days. Though I believe each one of us secretly considered himself to be invincible, we said out loud that if it came to it, we would go to our deaths like men. How naive we were. Little did I think then that there might be an outcome to that war worse than death. Walter was the first of us to go. I saw it happen myself, a sniper's lucky hit. It was late March and we were resting between battles, trying to keep warm and maintain morale among the men. Walter, being always the clown, was midway through an impression of a private called Boggs, who was doubly afflicted with a stutter and a nervous snorting laugh that resembled a pig snuffling for swill. As Walter reached the climax of his piece, the performance grew more boisterous, and he began playing to the gods, as it were. The sound of his men's jaded laughter must have encouraged him, because the next thing I knew, he was standing up on a crate and attempting an encore. As I said, we were at that time enjoying a brief respite both from the enemy's attack and from the incessant rain that seemed to fall on us daily like God's own tears. A freak break in the clouds gave the sun its chance, and as the light glinted off Walter's monocle, the sniper took his potshot. The bullet travelled straight through the jelly of Walter's left eye and out again through his skull, leaving a fist-sized hole as it departed. It then pierced the backside of the cook, who had been leaning over to break wind in the general direction of his oblivious commanding officer when the fatal shot was fired. We saved the cook, but Walter was dead before he hit the ground. Harry went a month later, but this time we were not there to see him go. His men heard him, though, for 2 days after he was hit, calling out from some muddy foxhole. He assured them that although his legs were trapped in some wire, he was otherwise tolerably fit and whole, and if a couple of the boys could just come out to him and cut him free, he really felt sure that a tight splint and a drop of brandy would set him quite to rights. Willie said it was superstition that kept Harry's men from going to his aid. Apparently, the word went round like trench fever that Harry was in fact already dead, and that this was just some clever ventriloquist trick by the enemy, impersonating Harry to draw them into a trap. It was a rumour that was only quelled when on the third night, Harry was heard screaming in agony as the rats began to eat him alive. Willie and I tried not to think of our fallen friends, but we often spoke of the happier times we'd spent in Cambridge before the winter of war sucked the heat and humour from our blood. We clung together. Not literally, of course, but in a spiritual sense, and mentally too. We slept in neighbouring bunks in our officer's dugout, and the still horizon of Willie's form, picked out by the dirty yellow of the candlelight, was the greatest comfort to me in those hellish, burrowing days. Then one day, the war ended for both of us. It was a murky morning in late August, and a party of wire cutters had sneaked out under cover of a grey mist to crawl ahead and lay waste to the enemy's defences. Willie and I were to lead what was left of the regiment over the top at 0600 hours, just at the time we hoped most of the Hun would still be slumped in whatever sleep they could scrounge. The idea was to surprise them and take control of the machine gun tower that had been picking off our boys for the last couple of days. It was a foolhardy and desperate mission, and Willie and I were under no illusions as to its possible outcome. We made the usual speeches, shook hands, and held each other's eye. Later on, I would remember with grief the bright intelligence in Willie's dear face as we talked of how we would return to Cambridge once this damn war was over. As the appointed time approached, we drew our men together and gave them what you'd describe as a pep talk, telling them that God and his angels were on our side and that Britain and her king were proud and grateful for the sacrifice they were about to make. Then, just as the ever-present crows began their first rough calls of the day, we took ourselves up over the top. Within a few minutes, our doom became apparent. The wire cutters had failed in their mission. The Germans were not caught napping, and the mist we had depended on for cover vanished all too quickly to reveal a clear and sunny dawn. That morning, the entire regiment, except me and Willie Fishford and Meadows, was wiped out, and what the crows were too faddy to touch soon became food for worms on that blood-fed Flanders field. Somehow or another, I must have half-carried, half-dragged Willie's unconscious body back to our lines that night. Apparently, when they found me, I was incoherent, raving and half-blind from the flashes of cannon that had been going off all around me. Willie's right leg had been blown off at the knee, and he had a nasty wound to his shoulder, but somehow, miraculously, and I use that term with no sense of joy, I appeared to be physically unscathed. My manner, though, gave to all intents and purposes the impression that my mind had been lost, and so they shipped us back to Britain together, the last remnants of the King's White Devils, and what ragamuffins we were. 3 months later, at a sanatorium in Bexhill-on-Sea, I was pronounced as fit as a fiddle, the darling of the nurses and the bauble of the physicians. Whatever shell shock I had sustained during that fatal raid, the memory of which I have never to this day been able to retrieve, had gone. I appeared physically and mentally whole. A little older and wiser, of course, but not an emotional wreck like all of those poor wretches around us. Doctors cheerfully pronounced me a miracle of science and wrote articles about me to justify their research grants. Willie, however, was not so fortunate. His shoulder and leg mended well enough, but the delicate connections of his synapses had melted away. When I looked at his face now, I saw only the ghost of the man I had once called my best friend. I stayed on at Bexhill, taking a little cottage in the town and visiting Willie every day, but the slowness of his progress began to take its toll on my spirits, especially on the days when he could do nothing but ramble about his childhood, a long time before I had known him. The nurses were kind enough, but I could tell that I was no better than a stranger to Willie, and that our friendship had perished on the battlefield the summer before. As the months went by, another niggling concern began to latch itself to my gloomy thoughts. The war was over now, and I had returned to my parents' home, where I attempted to adjust to civilian life, teaching Latin and Greek to the sons of the local gentry. I couldn't quite put my finger on it at the time, but a change had come over my appearance. A strange, hard-to-define shifting that at first would catch my eye in a mirror when I was least expecting it, but which went on to steadily engross my daily consciousness. Initially, I thought it was something to do with my eyesight, a resurgence of that temporary blindness I'd sustained in Flanders. I'd be shaving myself, and suddenly my reflection would seem to go wavy, like the ripples on a still pool when you throw a stone into it. I'd assume the glass had become fogged from the steam and go to wipe it with my sleeve, only to discover it was my reflection that was indistinct and misty, and not the glass at all. Or on other occasions, it would be friends or family who drew attention to it. My mother was constantly accusing me of sneaking up on her and catching her unawares. She would hold her hand up to her eyes and squint at me as if I were as bright as the sun and blinding her. And then she would shake her head from side to side, as though trying to shift a flea from her ear. Father experienced it differently. He was fairly nearsighted anyway and suffered from migraines, rather badly. He would self-medicate with whiskey and water most evenings and was quite often a little unsteady on his feet. He got into the habit of saying he knew he'd had too much when he saw his son go fuzzy round the edges, and we all used to laugh about it. But that was before things got worse. And if you want to find out how things got worse, you have to buy the book.